Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Arya Irani, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principal citizen of involvement of government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu to get more information. The title of today's forum is A View from the Edge of the Fiscal Cliff, What Happened and What's Next. Our guests today are Elizabeth M. Gore, former Chief of Staff and Legislative Director to U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan. Next, we have Alexander R. Dahl, former Deputy Staff Director and Senior Counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee and Assistant U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia. And finally, we have Jacob A. Johnson, former Legislative Assistant for Senator Orrin G. Hatch. So please join me in welcoming all of our guests. And now I'm going to turn it over to Elizabeth Gore.
Great. Thanks so much. We're delighted to be here. It's been nice to be in Utah. You guys do winter a lot more effectively than we do it in Washington. So it's nice to be here with a little bit of snow on the ground. We're going to be talking today about the fiscal cliff, why we had a fiscal cliff, how we got it resolved, and to what extent we got it resolved, and what's coming up next. So we're going to walk through those aspects of the fiscal cliff, and then we're going to talk about some of the larger political trends that we're seeing in Washington, D.C., and how they intersect with that particular dynamic. So I'm going to start off and talk about why we had the cliff in the first place. And it was a very interesting dynamic because this was a slow-motion train wreck. The story begins in December 2010. We'd just come through the midterm elections in November. The Democrats had done poorly, very poorly in those elections. They lost 6 Senate seats. They lost 60 House seats, including, and that caused them to lose the majority in the House. So Democrats were not in a very strong position politically. The Tea Party was on the rise. Obamacare was very unpopular, and so was President Obama. So, the president, with little political capital and other priorities that he wanted to pursue, decided that he was going to go ahead and extend the Bush tax cuts, which were scheduled to expire that month. He was going to go ahead and extend those for 2 years and delay the fight on tax cuts. Fast forward to July 2011, and the nation was rapidly reaching its statutory debt limit. And if we breached that debt limit, the federal government would be unable to pay its obligations, which would be a political and economic disaster. So there's a big fight about how we were going to address this challenge. And the ultimate compromise had a couple of different pieces. First, it cut federal spending by about $1 trillion. And second, it created a super committee, a committee that was tasked with finding another $1.2 trillion in deficit reductions. Could be through spending cuts, could be through tax increases, could be through a combination. And this bill that they passed to avert the debt crisis in the summer of 2011 had another piece to it. It was sort of the sword of Damocles. If the super committee was unable to be successful, there would be what they called sequestration, across-the-board cuts that would hit all parts of government, both defense and non-defense spending. And the idea was that this this mechanism was so arbitrary and would be so detrimental to so many different programs, so politically untenable, that no one would let it happen, that the threat of that coming down the pike would force compromise between the two sides. So there were high hopes for the super committee, and yet they didn't act. They didn't even put a proposal on the table. They couldn't get enough consensus to even put a plan forward. So by December of 2011, you had all the pieces of the fiscal cliff in place. You had sequestration, which was scheduled to go into effect in January 2013, and you had tax cuts, which were scheduled to expire at the very same time. Now, those tax cuts, they would impact just about every American household because they were so broad and so far-reaching. And as I said, the spending reductions would have had a very significant impact across all of government. So everything was in place in the December of 2011, and yet Congress and the administration wouldn't take any action. Nothing happened until after the election of 2012. So then we were all in this situation. You had 6 weeks until the fiscal cliff, and it greatly increased the pressure. The several attempts at a grand bargain fell apart. Negotiations between the leadership stalled. And yet, at the very end, through sort of a strange turn of events, they did come up with an agreement. And right as we turned into the new year, a package was passed by the House, or by the Senate, and then the House, and signed by the President. I'm going to turn over to Jacob, who's going to talk a little bit about how we got to that final package.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I want to talk about this a little bit just because I think it's very interesting and very unique how this package actually came together. I was one of, I think, many people in Washington who did not believe that we would get a deal on the fiscal cliff. I thought we were going over the cliff, so I was very surprised that they came to a deal. But I was also just very surprised by the way that it actually got done. So I think everyone knows that it was very difficult to negotiate in the weeks leading up to the fiscal cliff deal. House Speaker John Boehner was largely handcuffed by the fiscal conservatives in his caucus. They wanted to solve the problem through spending cuts and entitlement reform rather than tax increases. And so they didn't want to move from that position at all. They did not want to increase taxes on anyone. Just before Christmas, John Boehner brought his Plan B legislation to the floor of the House. That legislation would have raised taxes only on earners making more than $1 million a year. But even that, he had to pull from the House floor because it became apparent he didn't have enough support among his fellow House Republicans to pass that bill. So with that option off the table, it became difficult to see a package that could make it through the House. On the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, you've got President Obama, who had just won re-election. And throughout his campaign, he had promised that he was going to raise taxes on people and families making more than $250,000 a year. So he thought that he had the upper hand in those negotiations, and he also felt a lot of pressure from his fellow Democrats not to move from that number. So he was unwilling to make a deal. So there was a lot of political posturing, a lot of finger-pointing, but not much action was being taken toward making a deal. So just a few days before going off the cliff, at the direction of the White House, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell sat down again to see if they could come up with a compromise deal. But Senator Reid believed very strongly that Republicans would ultimately cave, that they would not let us go off the cliff. They would rather raise taxes than actually go off the cliff. So he didn't feel that there was any need to continue negotiations. So those negotiations also fell apart. So at that point, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell calls the Vice President, Joe Biden. And those two had actually worked on a tax deal back in 2010. So McConnell thought there might be some way that they could work together again. And so those two were able to come to a compromise. They looked at the issues and worked through them one by one and were able to come up with a deal that had enough consensus and enough support to pass the Senate by an 89-8 margin, which is a very bipartisan bill. Even at that point, you've got a very bipartisan bill. It was difficult to get it through the House. and House Republicans generally were upset that it would raise taxes and didn't include any spending cuts. So the bill only passed the House with very strong support from House Democrats. You had 151 House Republicans voted against the bill, and that includes the number two Republican leader in the House, Eric Cantor, and the majority of the House Republican leadership. So I think a lot of people voted for the bill because they thought it was better than the alternative, but I think a lot of people on both sides were a little upset with the final package. So now I'll turn it to Alex to talk a little bit about what's actually in the bill and a little bit about what's coming up.
Thank you. So now that you know a little bit more about why we had a fiscal cliff in the first place and the political background for the resolution that occurred, I want to talk more specifically about what the pieces of the fiscal cliff were, which ones of those were resolved, and therefore which ones are left to be resolved in the next couple of months. I think that the immediate attention on this issue has been largely focused on the Bush tax cuts, which were temporary tax cuts passed early in the Bush administration and were, as Elizabeth explained, set to expire. And the bill that was passed on New Year's Day this year extended those permanently with some modifications, particularly for people who earn over $400,000 or families that earn over $450,000 per year. But there are several other elements of the fiscal cliff, and those included a large number of tax provisions that largely affect corporations and big industries that were also set to expire. Largely in Washington, those go by the name of tax extenders. The sequestration that Elizabeth explained, which was set to go into effect, those are across-the-board budget cuts set to go into effect as of January 1st. The unemployment benefits were set to expire at the end of the year. There was also a provision that is a Medicare provision that pays doctors who see Medicare patients, and it's a large bill that costs about $25 billion a year to fix a schedule that would otherwise decrease the payments that those doctors receive. It's known in Washington as the Doc Fix. That was also set to expire. So those are an unusual number of big tax and spending provisions that were set to go into effect all at once, which is what led the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, to coin the term fiscal cliff to describe, when he warned last year that this was all coming, what was going to happen. So the fiscal cliff legislation, which was House Resolution 8, H.R. 8, that passed on New Year's Day of this year, resolved some but not all of those issues. It extended, as I mentioned, the Bush tax cuts with some changes. It extended a large number of tax provisions that affect corporations and industries, the tax extenders. It approved the Doc Fix legislation for another year and extended unemployment benefits for another year. What was left undone is resolution of the sequestration. The bill that was passed at the beginning of the year delayed it by 2 months. So instead of going into effect as of January 1, the spending cuts known as sequestration are now set to go into effect as of March 1st. Also, the way that the federal government gets funded every year through a series of appropriations bills last year was done in a way called a continuing resolution, just a resolution saying all the spending will stay the same for another year. In this case, they set it for 6 months. That provision expires March 27th. In other words, Congress has to do something to fund government, otherwise the funding stops on March 27th. And now an additional issue, which is the debt ceiling that Elizabeth mentioned. Our country is borrowing money at a rate which is going to run against the statutory debt ceiling. That's going to happen in the next several weeks, and Congress has to change the debt ceiling to enable the country to borrow enough money to pay the bills that is that are coming due. All these three items, the debt ceiling, sequestration, and the funding for the rest of 2013, have to be resolved, because if they don't, something bad is going to happen immediately without a resolution. But there are two other issues that are being discussed in Washington, and those are entitlement reforms, so reforms to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Those are by far the largest budget items for the federal government, and therefore the biggest part of the situation that's creating large debt and deficit, particularly as you look forward over the next number of years. And also the issue, of comprehensive tax reform. Now, that mostly has to do with corporations, because the individual tax rates were what was governed by the Bush tax cut extensions that have already been resolved by the bill that was passed on New Year's Day. So that's what's setting up to be the discussion in Washington for the next couple of months. Right after the bill was passed on New Year's Day, President Obama said that he would not negotiate about the debt ceiling. And so soon after that, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, said that he is going to require that every dollar increase in the debt ceiling had to be matched by a dollar of spending cut or other reform. And so that is set up for a major clash to see whether the debt ceiling is just going to be raised or whether it's going to be used as a mechanism to force some spending changes. So that's what's in the bill and what's left to be resolved. Now we're going to change to the second part of our presentation that Elizabeth described, and that is to give a flavor of bigger political issues that are related to this debate. So we're each going to make an observation about politics in general as it relates to this debate. And I'm going to start, and my topic is going to be about the polarization between the two parties in Washington. And the reason I'm interested in this is because I think that popular media and reporting has led to lots of discussion that there's such polarization that the system is broken, that Congress is dysfunctional, cannot work, and that people can't even sit down in a room together to talk about these important issues. So you've seen, I'll just give you a couple of anecdotes of how I see this in popular culture, in particular reporting. On CNBC for the last couple of weeks of the year, the reporters were wearing badges that said "Rise Above," urging the politicians to rise above politics and solve these problems. There was also, you may have seen, a story about the Starbucks locations in Washington, D.C., asked their employees to write the words "Come Together" on each cup that they served during the time that Congress was talking about the fiscal cliff issues, in hopes that they would be able to come together to an agreement that would solve these problems. So my observation is that there's a lot of truth to this idea. On the other hand, I think that to some extent that is sort of unfair to the fact that these issues of the role of government and how much the government should be taxing people and spending on programs, and in particular borrowing money to pay today for things that the bills are going to come due much later. And speaking to a group of young college-age people, what that largely means is come due when you all are going to pay it, and a reason for you all to pay attention to this debate. This is more to a lot of people involved than something that you sit down and work out. So the Republican in general, I'm going to do some stereotyping. This is not applied to everybody on each side, but I'm going to take a stab at defining in general the two sides of the debate. There are many members of the Republican Party who think that the government is just out of control, spending money, as the expression goes, like a drunken sailor, that it is inappropriate to borrow such large amounts of money to be paid back by future generations to spend on essentially things that make life more comfortable today. And in particular, because that not only are these debts going to come due at some point, but also in the meantime, the debt service burden that the government pays and the effect that higher taxes have on the economy are slowing economic growth today, in addition to putting off till down the road paying back the debt, the money that's being borrowed. And everybody has had a look at what has happened in Europe over the last couple of years, and there are some people who say that that's the kind of thing that's in our future, to take on so much debt the government is unable to handle paying it back later. On the other hand, many members on the Democratic side think that it is an entirely appropriate role of government to provide a safety net for the vulnerable parts of the population, and that particularly at a time like we've had over the last several years of economic uncertainty and dislocation, that that role is particularly important, and it would be a very bad time today to cut the programs that people are relying on for help, particularly when an option is to raise taxes on people who are making a considerable amount of money above the average American, and that those people have been paying tax rates over the last number of years that are historically much lower than they have paid in the past as their contribution to the government and to society. So I think that when you look at it in those terms of deeply held views, the idea that we could all just come together is pretty tough. If you believe that it is wrong to borrow heavily today and ask the future generations to pay back, then should you compromise by voting for more spending? And on the other hand, if you think that the government's role is a safety net for vulnerable populations, particularly at times of need, would you vote to start cutting back on those programs today? So these things are deeply held political views that are tough issues for people to compromise by getting in the room and shaking hands. As I mentioned, I think that these are particularly important issues for people of your age. I'm talking mostly to college students here, and the kinds of cuts that may occur could have a great impact immediately on spending for higher education and access to loans and grants to enable you to continue your education. On the other hand, as I said, the most of the debate about current spending versus debt has to do with future generations are going to be the recipients of the debt, while the today's recipients are the recipients of the money. So it's going to affect you both today and at a later time. One of the reasons why it's such a great thing to be here today at the Hinckley Institute, which is such a fantastic program helping to encourage discussion of these important topics, and through your programs here, but also the internships, is a great way to get a much more profound understanding of these issues. So I'm a huge fan of the Hinckley Institute. Our firm where the three of us work has had many interns from Hinckley, and a couple of them are sitting in the room here today, and we've been very happy with that association and have just tremendous admiration for the program and for Kirk Jowers, who's the director of the program, doing a great job.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about another theme, another trend that I see, and I have a little bit of a disagreement with Alex. We're from Washington, and I'm a Democrat, and he's a Republican, so we're required to disagree. And so let me just talk a little bit about the way I see things and correct Alex on his his views. And what I'm going to talk about is the hollowing out of the political center on Capitol Hill. Historically, we've had a very robust political middle. Again, talking in general terms, there's traditionally been moderate Republicans from New England, conservative Democrats from the South, and these this political center has been the place where compromise has been found, where solutions and common ground has been established, and you find policy solutions that can move forward through the process. And it has been in this middle, that middle has always been the key part of getting any sort of consensus or any sort of majority on different policy efforts. So over the last, this has been an ongoing trend over the last decade or so, and it's certainly accelerated in recent years, that middle has dissolved. If you look at New England, there are six New England states, so you have 12 Senate seats. There's only two Republicans in those 12 Senate seats. And there's 21 House seats in those six states, and there are no Republicans. And, you know, New England Republicans have been an important part of that party for a long time, and they have been almost completely eliminated in Congress. Similarly, you have Southern Democrats who are conservative. The Blue Dog Democratic Coalition is a group of moderate and conservative Democrats in the House. Their numbers have gone from about in the 50s, about 4 years ago, down to under 20. So their ranks have been, again, completely eroded over the last couple of election cycles. There's been various theories about why this has happened, but there's no question that it is happening. And it's a real problem in Washington because when you take away the political middle, you take away the policy middle. And this is where I disagree with Alex. I think there are, of course there are solutions to the budget problem in the middle. Of course there's room for compromise and room where you can have a package that has some tax increases, it's got some spending cuts, it has some sensible reforms in the entitlement area, and you bring all these pieces together and you have a compromise package that doesn't trend to one ideological end of the spectrum, but brings a lot of different pieces together in the middle. And the problem is that right now there's nobody to vote for that kind of package on Capitol Hill. Because the two sides have eviscerated the center of the political spectrum. Now, if you've got people on one side that say, if there's $1 in tax increases, I'm not going to vote for it. I'm not going to vote for it. Jacob was talking about, I'm not going to vote for tax increases even on people who make over $1 million. And on the other side of the spectrum, you've got people who say, Social Security, Medicare, completely off the table. We won't even look at that, even though, as Alex mentioned, those are the biggest parts of the budget. And so right now you just have nobody in the middle to take what they say the sensible center. And so I think that this has had a real impact on the way that Congress legislates, and it's a detriment, I think, to both political parties, to the Congress as a whole, and to the American people, because they are not able to find that compromise middle ground. So that's my perspective. I think that one of the reasons that Congress has such a low number of favorability of approval is that there isn't an effort, there isn't an ability by Congress now to move to the middle and find solutions that can incorporate the best ideas from both ends. So that's my perspective on it, and I'm going to turn it over to Jacob. He's going to talk a little bit about a different trend that he's seeing.
That's right, and I won't disagree with either one of you.
That's why we put him in the middle.
I think another major shift that we've seen in Congress in recent years is a breakdown in regular order. There's a process for moving legislation through Congress, and I think most of us are generally familiar with how that works. There are congressional committees in each chamber, and chairmen of those committees, and legislation moves through those committees before it even goes to the House or Senate floor. And that's how legislation advances. And those committees and those chairmen play a big part in the agenda and in what's included in that legislation. But in recent years, that process has been circumvented far more regularly to pass major legislation. On the fiscal cliff, for example, you have a major piece of largely tax legislation, and you have two people that are negotiating that bill. And they're doing it at the last minute, the 12th hour. So the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee, which have jurisdiction for tax laws, they had no say in the process at all. They had no say in the content of the bill. They didn't have committee votes. They didn't have an opportunity to amend the legislation at the committee level. And so that legislation, the fiscal cliff bill, it got simply an up and down vote on the floor of the Senate and an up and down vote on the floor of the House. And that means that no one, you didn't have an opportunity to amend it on the Senate or House floor either. So you either had to vote yes or no, and that was it. No opportunities to change the bill. I also think you can see the breakdown in regular order very clearly in the appropriations process in recent years. Congress should pass 12 appropriations bills each year, and those bills provide discretionary funding for the different federal agencies. Excuse me. So through that appropriations process, that's where you can make changes to federal spending priorities. That's where you can shift funding away from one program that's not performing well and put it in another one that you believe is doing better. That's where the rubber really meets the road. But you have to go back, I think, to 2006 was the last time that Congress passed all 12 appropriations bills individually. The bills will get rolled into a large omnibus bill, which is thousands and thousands of pages long, and no one can read that legislation, and it's very difficult to break it down into the individual programs. Or Congress puts the legislation on what's called a continuing resolution, or a CR, and that funds the government at the previous year's levels, and that just avoids any decision-making at all. You just kick the can down the road and make decisions later. So members are put in this position where they either have to, again, have an up-and-down vote, either vote for a large omnibus bill, vote for a continuing resolution, or vote to shut down the federal government. And that's a very difficult vote to take. So without regular order, I think it's very difficult for members to feel engaged in the process. It's very difficult for them to negotiate, to offer amendments, to compromise at all. And I think when you have two members or a handful of members who are negotiating, you have fewer viewpoints reflected in the legislation, and I think that makes the legislation worse. And I just generally don't believe that that's a very good way to legislate. So I think that breakdown in regular order has really impacted Congress and its ability to get things done.
Hello.
So now we will devote the remainder of time to questions from the audience. Please speak directly into the microphone, introduce your name, and say a little bit about yourself before your question. So any questions?
Thank you.
My name is Cody Whitehead. I'm just a pre-business student right now. I'm planning on doing a double major in marketing and entrepreneurship. And I'm horrible with names. What was your name, ma'am?
I'm Elizabeth.
Elizabeth. My question was, I agree with you about if you take away the political middle, you take away the policy middle about your saying, but what is the best way to achieve that political middle again, in your opinion, I guess?
That is an excellent question. And I think that we'll know more later. No. I think that the way to figure out the solution is to look at the causes of the problem or the causes of this evolution. And there's a lot of different theories for why it's happened. And let me just run through a couple of them. And the bottom line is that it's hard to reverse any of these. And so it's hard to see how we solve the problem, which is a little bit too bad. So here are some of the reasons that people point to. One is redistricting. We have more and more congressional districts are drawn so that they are very solidly Republican or very solidly Democrat. And so what happens is if you are in a district that is very, very Republican, your concern is not about an opponent that is going to run for you from the Democratic Party next November. You're worried about somebody who's going to come in a primary and be more conservative than you are. And so it drives people to the outside of the political spectrum. So that's one thing that people point to. Now, that doesn't explain the situation in the Senate, but I think it is at least part of the explanation in the House. And Alex has a statistic that he mentions, and I think it's almost every House Republican.
Right. I think there are 9 or so that don't fall in that category.
So you have almost every House Republican is from a seat that voted for Mitt Romney for president. So it's very it is a very polarized situation. Some of the other causes that people point to, the fact that you have a lot of outside money that comes in on these elections now. And so the political parties aren't as strong, and therefore they don't have as much influence as to determine who they want to run on their side of the ballot. And then when somebody does win, they don't have the same loyalty to the party. They don't have the same. They don't feel as though they owe anything to the leadership of their party, and therefore they're harder to lead. Another issue that people point to is that communities are becoming more more homogenous in terms of their political views. That if you actually look at the data, there's less intermingling of Democrats and Republicans just in terms of where they live. And some people attribute that to sort of social media and a 24-hour news cycle, and people just listen to the news that reflects their views. And so... There are theories about that, and that has made the geography and the politics such that it's hard to elect people from the middle. I don't have a good solution on how to answer or how to solve the problem. I just think that it is an unfortunate development because, as I mentioned earlier, it takes away a great opportunity to find compromise.
So I think I'll just try kind of a big picture statement also on that is that, in essence, what you have is that members of Congress aren't losing elections because the voters say, we wanted someone who would compromise. We wanted you to get together and make a deal. But rather the opposite is that voters are voting in favor of people who say, well, I went back there and I stuck with what I said I was going to do. And I think that it leads to an interesting disconnect because there has to be some difference between how voters are voting for those people who stick with their principles but yet have such a horribly low opinion of Congress and where nothing can get done without compromise. You know, a legislative body isn't a place where you go in and just stick to your guns. It's a place where you have to go... sit down at the table knowing that you're going to give up something that's important to you and have somebody on the other side doing the same thing. That's the atmosphere that leads to compromise. You're talking about getting 525 people to vote for something. Not everybody's going to be happy with that. So But the bottom line is that it's going to take a couple of people losing their elections because the voters say, we wanted you to make a deal. We didn't want you to just stick by your guns at the cost of doing nothing.
Hi, my name is Nicole Goodrich, and I just have a couple of questions. How is this going to affect our education? Are we still going to be able to, is tuition, is that going to drop, as well as what's going to happen to, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security?
So I think the answer to that question is a couple parts. Sequestration, which we've talked about, that does not impact, it has a small effect on Medicare, but it essentially affects discretionary programs, not entitlement programs. Absolutely, that's going to have an impact on some of the programs where there is funding that comes to the University of Utah.
And what can we do as college students to help that?
I think every time you all engage, you're the best lobbyists for the programs that you care about and for the benefits that you receive from federal support. So anytime you can engage in the process, you are serving yourself and your fellow students very well. I think in terms of some of these other deadlines that we have coming up in terms of the, Alex mentioned entitlement reform, we have the funding bills that expire at the end of March. There's a lot of uncertainty of how different programs are going to be treated there. But I think that the best money is that there are going to be continued reductions in those areas, in those funding streams. And one of the questions is just how that's going to manifest itself. I don't think anyone knows yet.
Hi, I'm Satine. I'm a pre-med political science major. And my question is for all of you, I guess. What steps, if any, are being taken to promote accountability and transparency in, government in terms of who's being paid for? I mean, what is being paid for with what taxpayer dollars and who is working for whom in terms of political lobbying and special interest groups?
Great question. So as far as the what particular tax dollars are going to what particular programs, in general, that's not the way the federal government works, but rather collects into a general fund tax revenue from all sources, income taxes and others, and that there's a general revenue fund that then gets appropriated by Congress, and those were the 12 spending bills that we were talking about, that Congress decides which agencies and which programs within those agencies have access to those funds for those particular programs. And there are a few discrete federal programs that have dedicated funding, but it's very rare. In general, that just isn't the way it works. As far as disclosure, there are a number of laws about that, and you mentioned in particular lobbying. There are fairly robust requirements that make it a public record that everybody who is paid to weigh in with the government has to file a quarterly report, and those are publicly available for people to read.
My name is Tyler Chapman, and I'm a physics major. My question is regarding the breakdown in the regular order, and I'd like to know where this regular order originated and how are legislators able to circumvent that since 2006?
Sure, that's a good question. The committees are set up by the rules of each individual house. So the Senate rules create the all of the different committees, judiciary, finance,
Appropriations, Armed Services.
All the rest of those committees. And the House does the same. So it's the each body has their own governing rules, and they vote on those rules at the start of each legislative session.
And if I can just say, the reason that those are put into place is it gave people an area of expertise where they would really focus. So if you look at the Armed Services Committee, the chair and ranking member of that committee have been working on those issues, focused on those issues. The reason that you arrange the committee system is so that there can be some specialization.
Right. And as far as the reason that they are able to circumvent it, it goes back to those rules as well. There's leadership. There's a majority leader and a minority leader. On the Senate side, there's a Speaker of the House and a minority leader and a majority leader on that side as well. And they decide ultimately what legislation gets advanced on the floor of the Senate and the floor of the House. So it's within their purview. It's within their responsibilities to make that decision.
I want to follow up with one good example. First of all, the background is, as Jacob explained, the fiscal cliff bill is an example that it was negotiated by a couple of people and then just put before the full Senate and House for votes. So that's one way it can happen. But I think one of the most interesting exceptions to regular order that's happened in the last couple of years is the super committee that was created by a vote of Congress last year. As Jacob pointed out earlier, we already have committees for writing tax rules and governing the appropriations bills and therefore the spending amounts. But Congress came together to form a new committee system, the super committee. And so they created, in a time of sort of acute pressure on those issues, a new way of handling deciding those issues. And it ultimately failed. And I think there were a lot of us who weren't surprised by the fact that creating a new kind of order at the same time of needing to resolve some very important things was a risky proposition as compared to using the committees that have already been set up for that purpose. And so, so that one happened by a vote of Congress as opposed to a kind of a compromise deal made by a couple of people.
My name is Logan. I'm a math major, and I just thought the introductions were a little bit short. I was wondering if you could give a brief explanation, a brief highlight of your responsibilities, either now or what they've been in the past. Each of you.
Sure. Do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. So I worked on Capitol Hill for about just over 20 years. I worked in the House, and I worked in the Senate, and then I worked 2 years in the Clinton administration. So I have a long career in public service, all on the Democratic side of the aisle. And then when the senator that I was working for retired, I left the Senate and I started working at Brownstein Hyatt Farber Schreck, where I am working now. And I'm a lobbyist. I have a portfolio of clients that I work on. And my favorite one is the University of Utah. And so a lot of my day-to-day work has to do with interacting with people on Capitol Hill and in the administration and either educating or advocating on behalf of my clients on particular portfolio of issues.
I'm Jacob Johnson. I actually grew up down in Castledale in Emory County. Been in D.C. for 11 or 12 years. I worked on Senator Hatch's staff for a number of those years, and I handled a variety of issues for him, transportation, I helped out with natural resources issues, and just a lot of different things. I've been with Brownstein for about 5 years now, and the clients that I work on generally fall into those spaces. In natural resources, I do a lot of water. Obviously, at the University of Utah, I help out with a lot of federal funding issues and things like that, and do that with several clients, and then have other clients that fall in the transportation space.
I grew up here in Salt Lake City, and I am a graduate of the University of Utah Law School. after I graduated, I was a lawyer here in Salt Lake City, and at the time was thinking about the sort of coincidence in my mind that one of my senators, Orrin Hatch, happened to be the chairman of the Judiciary Committee when I was very interested and a young lawyer. So I applied for a position to work on the Judiciary Committee as part of the chairman's staff, Chairman Hatch's staff, and got hired to do that. I spent 5 years in a couple of different roles working on the Judiciary Committee and had a great experience there, and worked with a lot of Hinckley interns in that office during that time. I left the Hill and went to work for the Department of Justice. I was a criminal prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, and did that for a couple years before joining Brownstein, the firm where we all work, about 6 or 7 years ago. And my work now involves a lot of the issues that can come up before the Judiciary Committee, as well as a variety of other things, including a fair amount of healthcare work as well. Does that answer your question? Good.
So please join me in thanking Alexander Dahl, Jacob Johnson, and Elizabeth Gore for an excellent and informative forum. Thank you so much.